Innovative information-based radio, 6220 daytime, 1611 nighttime. This is Radio Facts, the trade station. Number 1, High Ash Farm, K-Store St. Edmund, England, NR148RH.
A report now by Ivor Owen from the Financial Times, calling for more competition on company satellite links. Private sector rivals to British Telecom and Mercury should be able to compete in providing multinational companies with their own private telecommunication services by space satellite, Viscount Caldicott, Conservative, suggested in the House of Lords. He urged the government to make an early announcement that the present duopoly employed by BT and Mercury in providing such services to the UK would cease after 1990. Lord Caldicott, a former president of the Society of British Aerospace Companies, envisaged that such an announcement would provide the incentive needed for other operators to form a consortium with financial institutions. He said the groups involved in the construction of the Channel Tunnel had illustrated the scope for exploiting long-term investment opportunities, but an early government announcement was essential.
From the Journal of the Institution of Electronic and Radio Engineers. A novel approach to the design of insulators in MF tower broadcast antenna stays by Professor J.V. Sirutka and A.R. Jordvik from the Department of Electrical Engineering, University of Belgrade, Yugoslavia. The most commonly used antennas for medium and low frequency broadcast use are vertical steel masts, which are kept in an upright position by means of steel stay cables. The usual mast height is between 0.1 and 0.65 of the operating wavelength. In order to suppress the induced radio frequency currents in the stays, and thus to avoid the influence of these currents on the antenna radiation pattern, the stays are normally divided into sections, much shorter than the wavelength, by means of special insulators. The stay insulators are subject to two kinds of voltage, induced RF voltages due to the antenna currents and electrostatic voltages due to the atmospheric electrostatic field. The RF voltages are practically time invariant, and they depend only on the radiated power. However, the electrostatic voltages are variable and can sometimes reach very high values, of the order of several hundred kilovolts, especially immediately before or during thunderstorms. In these weather conditions, the static voltages are much higher than the RF voltages. Although the stay insulators are normally designed to sustain high static voltages, these voltages can produce flashovers between metal fittings which are placed at both ends of the insulators. The static voltages and the flashovers they produce are not particularly dangerous when the transmitter power is low. Problems do arise, however, in the case of high power transmitters. Once the static voltage has caused a breakdown of the insulator spark gap, the induced RF voltage can maintain the arc even if the voltage is much smaller than that needed to trigger a flashover. If an arc occurs at an insulator connecting the stay to the antenna mast, the antenna input impedance will probably be appreciably changed, and the transmitter's reflectometer protection system will momentarily interrupt the transmission, thus extinguishing the arc. The only consequence will be a very short break in transmission. However, a flashover across an insulator which is not in contact with the mast structure will probably not activate the protection system, and RF energy will maintain the arc. In the case of high power transmitters, the power of the RF arc can be considerable, and the thermal stresses can damage the insulator. In the absence of a system for extinguishing such arcs, the safety of the mast can be jeopardized. Particularly in the case of insulators whose fittings are not interlinked, the prolonged arc can cause catastrophic consequences for the antenna mast. The problem described above, which plagues many MF and LF broadcasting stations, is gaining increasing importance at the present time due to the steady increase in the powers of MF and LF transmitters, which are often in excess of several hundred or even thousand kilowatts. In order to avoid annoying and even dangerous consequences caused by the static atmospheric electricity, several methods have been suggested and developed. The oldest and most commonly used method for avoiding static discharges and accompanying RF arcs is the use of high-resistance static leak resistors connected in parallel to each insulator. except to those which connect the stays to the antenna mast structure. These resistors leak the electric charges from the stays to earth, thus preventing the accumulation of static voltages. Although this may seem to be an ideal solution of the problem, it is far from being perfect in practice. A direct or near lightning stroke may destroy the resistors so that the insulators remain unprotected with no visible indication. In recent times, special arc detectors sensitive to the ultraviolet radiation or RF noise emitted by an arc have been developed. Another interesting form of detector measures the RF currents in the lowest sections of the stays by means of current transformers and compares them. When an arc occurs, these detectors activate protection devices which interrupt the transmission for a short interval and extinguish the arc. If the system operates correctly, the number of these interruptions may be so high during stormy weather and immediately before it that listening to the program becomes unpleasant. Since the arc detectors remove the consequences, but not the cause of, arcs, some completely new technical solutions which avoid the use of stay insulators have recently been proposed and realised. Among these, the most notable are replacing the steel stays by plastic ones, the use of self-supporting towers, and the use of certain antenna types with steel stays without insulators. Non-metallic stays are made of modern synthetic fibres. Although these have remarkable electrical and mechanical properties, there is still insufficient experience of their behaviour over a long period of time. Also, the material is not resistant to high temperatures and fire. Self-supporting tower antennas have neither stays nor insulators, so there are no problems regarding static voltages, but they have two serious shortcomings: high price and a wide and varying tower cross-section, which makes it impossible to obtain a proper anti-fading vertical radiation pattern, if such a pattern is required. The deficiencies of the above solutions confirm, at the present state of the art, and particularly in the case of high anti-fading antennas, the choice of the slender classical mast with insulated stays, which must, however, have an efficient system for eliminating static electricity. A simple and efficient solution for eliminating static electricity from the insulated steel stays has been proposed and realised by one of the authors. This solution consists in using static drain coils, which are connected in parallel to the stay insulators, except those adjacent to the mast, forming with them anti-resonant circuits at the antenna operating frequency. This system was first installed in 1977 on the steel mast antenna 235 metres high of the main MF transmitter of Radio Belgrade, 684 kHz, radiating a power of 2000 kilowatts. Since that time, no flashovers or arcs on stay insulators have been reported. The elimination of dangerous static voltages from stay insulators leaves only relatively small, steady and predictable RF voltages. This fact changes the basic philosophy of the insulator design. Instead of expensive and bulky insulators designed for high electrostatic voltages, the draining coils enable much cheaper and lighter insulators to be used, which are designed to withstand only relatively small RF voltages. The design procedure now requires a suitable method for evaluating these RF voltages with sufficient accuracy. Numerical results and conclusions. The procedure described was applied in the design of the stay insulators of the new MF broadcast antenna, which is under construction for Radio Titograd. The antenna operating frequency is 882 kHz, and the unmodulated carrier power is 600 kilowatts. The mast height is 185 metres, and the mast equivalent radius is 756 millimetres. The mast has four levels of stays, which are arranged in three vertical planes, symmetrically placed at 120 degree angles. The first solution was tried with egg-shaped insulators, the flashover voltage of which, at 300 kHz in wet conditions, is 14 kV. The highest voltages were present at the insulators which were connected to the mast. In order to reduce these voltages, an attempt was made to increase the number of insulators forming a chain in the immediate vicinity of the mast. However, for mechanical reasons, the insulator midpoints could not be placed closer than about 1.5 metres. Consequently, increasing the number of insulators next to the mast to more than five did not in practice reduce the voltage across the first insulator connected to the mast. In contrast to this, placing two insulators instead of one at locations which are further away approximately halves the insulator voltage. Static charge draining coils of inductance 1.2 mHs were assumed to be placed across all the insulators except those connected to the mast, because the mast has its own draining coil at the base. In the computations, the insulators were approximated by 4.5K resistances uniformly distributed over 1.5 metres.
Now, extracts from a report for the financial year 1986-87 on the activities of Radio Communications Division of the Department of Trade and Industry, and specifically on the DTI's Radio Investigation Service, or the RIS. The job of the RIS is to keep degradation to authorised radio communications to an acceptable level, to investigate interference and to ensure that use of radio and radio frequencies throughout the spectrum conforms to licence and regulatory requirements. Its top priority is to deal with interference which could endanger lives, and its second priority to respond to problems which could disrupt the operations of businesses. During the last year, the RIS has carried out inspection programmes of stations, licences and installations in various classes of private mobile radio, or PMR, marine radio, amateur radio, citizens' band radio, and of local authority alarm systems, shop alarm systems, special event broadcasting, theatre radio microphone users, and industrial microwave use. The RIS policy team has assisted in European consideration of legislation to improve the radio environment and in drafting national legislation and policies to the same end. It has also provided information and answered questions on RIS work, which radio users and the public show a lively interest. The RIS carried out checks on 9,000 existing PMR stations and issued new licences to a further 1,500 after initial inspection. Of the existing stations checked, which had been previously issued with a licence, 40% either did not conform with the licence conditions or the radio systems were not in use. In new stations, the non-conformity rate was 23%. The discrepancies were generally sorted out following RIS advice or warning. However, where discrepancies had serious implications for other users, the RIS had to put restrictions on the use of the station or delay issue of the license until they were corrected. In 21 cases, persistent misuse resulted in prosecution. It is noticeable that in parts of the country where the RIS is well advanced with its PMR inspection programme, the levels of complaints from PMR users about communications problems is far lower than in areas where pressure of work has not permitted such progress. In a nationwide campaign to counter licence evasion and abuse of CB, RIS visited 6,600 households, of whom 4,000 were found to be operating without a licence or outside licence conditions. Whilst warnings proved sufficient in the majority of cases, 103 operators were interviewed under caution and had their equipment seized with a view to prosecution. RIS visited 13,100 small vessels during a campaign to check licence compliance on boats and to check that radio operators held certificates of competence. Letters were left explaining the need for licences and for the equipment to meet the specified standard. The use of radio on small boats has risen dramatically in recent years, and the campaign resulted in significant uptakes of licences and in people obtaining certificates of competence. This should improve operating standards, about which there have been persistent complaints. Towards the end of the year, the number of land-based unlicensed broadcasting stations increased, operating mainly at weekends. This increase was accompanied by a growth of complaints of interference from a wide range of radio users, from aeronautical services to householders suffering jamming of their favourite radio programmes. By the end of the year, the RIS had acted 271 times against 66 unlicensed broadcasters, mainly in London, Birmingham and Merseyside. 69 people were convicted for their involvement with those stations. Overall, there were 644 prosecutions under the Wireless Telegraphy Acts as a result of RIS investigations. all but seven resulted in convictions. 2,776 formal warnings were given for failure to meet licence requirements. Coming next is extracts of regarding offshore pirate radio stations and business domestic users from the Radio Investigation Service of the DTI. Radio Investigation Service, which is part of the Radio Communications Division of the Department of Transport and Industry, has continued to help the police on investigations of offences related to broadcasting outside territorial waters. As a result, summonses have been issued by the Crown Prosecution Service against nine people alleging offences under the Marine etc. Broadcasting Offences Act 1967 in connection with the operation of Radio Laser. The MV Communicator, from which Radio Laser broadcast, put into Harwich Harbour on November 1985. Neither the RIS nor police had powers to stop the ship leaving in November 1986, and broadcasts resumed afterwards for a short period under the name Laser Hot Hits. However, reputable companies were well aware that it is an offence to advertise on such stations, such as Radios Caroline and Laser, so that they have no prospect of commercial viability. Investigations continue into offences related to their operations, and other countries bordering the North Sea have offered their help. On business and domestic users, during the year, the RAS received 2,664 complaints from business users of radio who had identified an interference problem, the source of which was outside their own systems. 160 users engaged the RIS on a consultancy basis to advise them on their own systems, for which a standard charge of £41 per man per site per hour on site plus VAT is charged. The RIS received 4,372 reports from householders of possible sources of interference. Many of these have helped the RIS to target its enforcement work, for example, on misuse of CB, amateur and marine radio, and unlicensed broadcasting. The winter seasonal rise in complaints shows that central heating thermostats are still a potent source of problems. Tall structures such as cranes also periodically cause local problems. The RIS received 715 requests accompanied by the standard fee of £21 from households to visit them to diagnose the cause of their reception problems. Well, that was an extract from a report on the radio investigation services, which was contained in a report for the financial year 1986-87 on the activities of the Radio Communications Division of the Department of Trade and Industry.
We're on the air to demonstrate the kind of service we will be providing every day of the week, starting during the summer. What we are seeking is a licence to transmit from the United Kingdom, instead of hiring transmission facilities abroad. If you would like our specially printed QSL card, please send 50 pence in British stamps or 3 international reply coupons to Radio Fax, number 1, High Ash Farm, Case Store St Edmund, England, NR148RH. And don't forget that every letter we receive helps our application for a licence to transmit from England.
A seminar at the Novotel Hotel in London. Non-chlorofluorocarbon-based cleaning techniques in electronic manufacturing. Following concern about the proven depletion of the ozone layer, Britain has signed an international agreement which comes into force at the beginning of 1989. This agreement, limiting the emissions of chlorofluorocarbons into the environment, which will have repercussions for all electronic manufacturers currently using CFC-113. It is important that producers of printed circuit boards be made aware of the alternative non-CFC-113-based cleaning methods, together with their implication in terms of equipment, testing and cost. The seminar will overview the international agreement and summarise the proposed controls on CFC emissions, and will focus on the management and technological issues that need to be resolved before introducing non-CFC-based cleaning methods. The seminar will include presentations by industrialists on their experience of using non-CFC-based cleaning methods and will explore questions of effectiveness and costs of alternative cleaning methods. The underlying technical issues will also be considered. The selection of fluxes with respect to the implications of particular cleaning methods, together with testing techniques to ensure that the chosen process is achieving the required specification, will be discussed. The seminar aims to address detailed technical topics as well as management issues to ensure that the seminar fully meets the requirements of both senior management and engineering personnel. The one-day programme is practical and industry-based and includes discussions of proven non-CFC cleaning applications. A mini-exhibition will run concurrently with the seminar, giving the opportunities to see equipment and products discussed during the day. Now, the registration information for this seminar, the fee for the one-day seminar is at £185 plus VAT, which includes attendance at technical sessions, lunch and refreshments throughout the day. The event takes place at the Novotel Hotel, Hammersmith International Conference Centre in London. And the phone number for registration bookings is in Sunderland, 091 567 6191, extension 42. 091 567 6191, extension 42. And now we hear from Roger Tate.
The following comes from Radio Netherlands.
Time now to switch to compact disc music, and I'm joined by our contributor, Roger Tate.
Thank you. Thanks, Jonathan. Well, the difference is that the music you're hearing is coming to you not from a compact disc, but from a gold-coloured 5-inch CDV, or compact disc video. Here in the studio, I've got the Numerance LV11 CDV player that has just been launched onto the Japanese home market.
So what exactly can this player do?
Well, basically, it's a machine that'll play conventional compact discs, but it'll also play the new 5-inch clip discs, the new CDVs, which will also be available in longer 8-inch and 12-inch versions too. It'll also play the older LaserVision discs as well. Now, this type of machine is called a combi player, or combination player. It's all very new at the moment, but over the next year or so, companies such as Philips and Marantz are hoping that such players will become as commonplace as ordinary compact disc players.
But in the long run, are they going to actually replace the ordinary compact disc player then?
Well, all the publicity in Europe and the United States is certainly making many would-be CD purchasers actually stop and think. They're saying to themselves, now why on earth should I buy an expensive CD machine this year when CDV is just around the corner? In fact, I think they're being very wise, but maybe they're under a misapprehension.
But why is that then?
Well, you see, the publicity from the makers implies that one of these new machines can offer audio quality that is certainly as good as an ordinary CD player, as well as offering broadcast quality pictures. In other words, there's no need to own a compact disc player at all, as a CDV player will play both types of disc and give superb quality.
Well, so much for the manufacturer's brochure, but what about your listening results?
After listening to this particular first-generation machine, I must say I'm a little bit disappointed with the quality of sound that it gives. It sounds rather bright and harsh, and doesn't have the same stereo soundstage as, say, my own CD65 from Marantz, which is one of their mid-priced machines.
So, and all then, thumbs down for CDV already?
No, because it's not as simple as that, Jonathan. I said that the glossy brochures all promise broadcast quality pictures. Well, in this respect, CDV certainly can live up to expectations, providing that you can find a decent CDV pressing. Now, I've been looking around at some Japanese press discs, and they're really excellent, particularly considering that they're NTSC. Now, here in Europe, we use PAL. And although PAL is certainly reputed to offer much better definition and better colour saturation than NTSC, I have found that these Japanese pressings are every bit as good as PAL discs. Mind you, I've also seen quite a few bad examples of CDV pressings, which have been marred by flashes and speckles. It would seem that the Philips DuPont pressing plant in Blackburn in northern England is having problems with quality control.
Well, of course, we still don't know the exact price of these CDV discs when they're going to be released in the shops. When can we actually expect them?
Well, Jonathan, it all depends upon what part of the world you live in. Now, personally, I think that it'll be the spring of 1988 before large numbers of players are available in the UK. The same really goes for the rest of Europe, with players also promised from Pioneer and Yamaha. In Japan, CDV is already on the market. The machine I've got in the studio here sells in Japan for around 152,000 yen. That's about £650. It's probably manufactured by Pioneer for Marantz, as they have an identical model that they call the CLD-70 in Japan. And it's due on the American market fairly soon, where it's going to be called the CLD-1010. So really, we're in the very early days of CDV, and of course the supply of these little 5-inch gold discs is also rather short.
I love these tight numbers that manufacturers give their products. But what about the discs themselves? It looks as though there are going to be very few discs actually available when it's launched.
Well, that's the case at the moment. Now, some record companies have released a few CDVs to publicise the new format. In fact, there's a Level 42 CDV, one by Go West and one by Curiosity Killed the Cat. They're all supposed to be available right now here in the UK, although I've had no luck in tracking them down anywhere here in London.
Well, we've also done some checking in the Netherlands, West Germany and Belgium, and indeed, no luck there either. So does that mean that new owners of this marvellous technology are simply going to have no software to play then on their new machines?
Well, that's not quite true, because of the way in which CDV has actually developed. You see, in some ways, CDV is really a relaunch of the older LaserVision format. And CDV owners will be able to draw upon the vast back catalogue of LaserVision discs and play them on their new CDV machines.
But what do you mean by a relaunch? How does a LaserVision and a CDV system differ?
Well, the ill-fated LaserVision format offered the same picture quality as CDV, but only analogue sound on the PAL discs. Now, LaserVision never really caught on, but not because of any technical reason. It was thought by Philips that users would want to watch blockbuster films again and again, and thus would rush out to buy video discs. Now, in reality, people were reluctant to buy films when for a few pounds they could rent them on tape just for the night. Music releases were few and far between on the old LaserVision format, and unfortunately, LaserVision flopped. Now, had there been more music titles, then maybe LaserVision could have been more successful.
So what's your opinion then about CDV?
Well, as I said, it's a relaunch. LaserVision has been given a digital soundtrack, making it technically compatible with compact disc. A new 5-inch disc has been invented that will play on ordinary compact disc players, and the whole idea jumps on the bandwagon of CD's success.
So in the long term, do you see CDV as being successful as the compact disc once it really gets going?
Ha! I'm afraid that I'm rather cynical, Jonathan. You see, when LaserVision was released, I sat in this very studio and I made the same comments about software availability. Now, as a LaserVision user over the past few years, I know the frustration of seeing a title appear on VHS tape and then the long, long wait before the same title appears on video disc. The whole point about music videos is that they're made available when the record is popular and not months later. If it proves difficult for record companies to get their products onto the market quickly, perhaps due to, well, say, production problems, then I fear a whole rerun of the LaserVision fiasco. Now, I hope I'm wrong, Jonathan, because I'm personally a great fan of pictures from a silver or even a golden disc. Of course, the success of CDV depends on people buying the machines and, of course, buying the discs. It all comes down to marketing. It'll be interesting to see if Philips and the other manufacturers and the record companies have got it right this time round.
Well, indeed, Roger. It's going to be fascinating to see what manufacturers actually charge for those gold discs. After all, if there's only a few cents or pence difference between a CDV disc with 20 minutes of music plus a video clip and the audio-only compact disc with anything up to 70 minutes of music on it, I wonder whether, especially the youth market, will prefer to go for the CDV after all. Also, don't try to send PAL CDV discs used in Europe and Australasia to friends in North America, Japan or Brazil, where they use the NTSC colour system. They will be able to hear the music on the disc, but they won't be able to decipher the picture. I'm afraid it's the video recorder problem all over again. And there's one more piece of news to add. When we phoned the Polygram company in the Netherlands last week, they told us that CDV discs won't be launched now until September of 1988. They've been having quality control problems with the new golden discs.
Interested in improving AM reception? We will be producing a high-performance synchronous detector circuit board, which is designed to greatly improve reception quality of weak or selectively fading AM signals. The board is designed to accept a 455 GHz IF input at any level, so it will suit most communications receivers. There are two selector switches. The first sets the phase lock loop bandwidth, wide, medium or narrow. Where signals are fading rapidly and the carrier phase changes quickly, or where the carrier is phase-modulated with data, as on the various long-wave services, then the wider loop characteristics must be used. The second switch has six positions. Position 1 is a low-distortion envelope detector. Position 2 is normal double sideband synchronous detection. Position 3 gives upper sideband, and position 4 gives lower sideband. Position 5 is called stereo spread and gives fascinating effects with upper sideband on the left and lower sideband on the right. Position 6 is also unique in giving quadrature, which means that the modulation from the strongest station on the channel is nulled out, so any station beneath can be heard more clearly. Synchronous reception reduces the distortion experienced with a selectively fading signal, but does not help with the objectionable surging in audio level. The final unique feature, then, of this board is that it includes a broadcast-quality audio limiter with multiple time constants, which controls the peak audio level. Of course, another benefit of synchronous reception is the signal-to-noise improvement, which results from rejection of noise and interference not in phase with the received signal carrier. The production board will not be ready until July and will be around £150. But if you would like to be on the mailing list for details, send along 1 13-pence British stamp or 1 international reply coupon to Radio Fax, number 1, High Ash Farm, K-Store St. Edmund, England, NR148RH.
And now a report by Jane Tyne, the media correspondent in the Daily Telegraph this Easter Saturday. Swearing on radio brings rift to BBC. The heads of BBC Radio are to reassess their policy on bad language following a rift between executives and the corporation's producers over which swear words are acceptable in programmes during the day. Complaints from its drama producers after a play was cancelled last month and two plays withdrawn from afternoon repeats have led Mr. Michael Green, controller of Radio 4, to call a seminar on bad language. The producers complain that Radio 4's policy means the BBC, which should be a showcase for innovative drama, is failing in its duty to provide new writing and occasionally to shock audiences. They also claim that too much attention is paid to listeners' complaints. They are opposed by Mr. John Green and by Mr. John Tyndham, head of Radio Drama. "We can tackle the most demanding subjects, sexual or political, during the day, but language is different," said Mr. Green. "Words now considered most offensive are banned on Radio 4, and their use in drama must be referred to the network controller. This leads to delays which, according to producers, deters new writers and means that BBC Radio Drama suffers. One of the key problems is that drama, which is broadcast late at night, often has a repeat scheduled on Saturday afternoons when there are many young listeners. Excess Baggage by Ken Blakeson, a play about soldiers' domestic lives, which was broadcast last month in a late-night Monday play, had its repeat cancelled after complaints about the language. A week later, Mr. Green withdrew a repeat of The Cassandra Generation by Frederick Harrison, a play about the effects of the Falklands War. Following a similar seminar to discuss violence on television, Mr. Michael Checkland, Director General, said, "Respecting the audience's right to make an informed choice means not allowing threatening or shocking material to intrude unexpectedly into the privacy of the home without good and sufficient reason."
From Broadcast Systems Engineering, Continental Electronics. James Wood turns his attention to Continental Electronics, a division of Varian Associates Incorporated, a giant manufacturer with the widest range of FM transmitters in the world. The two giant companies in the United States are Harris and Continental. Drawing parallels between the two is not easy, and to attempt this would be a pointless exercise. It is sufficient to say that they are not just US market leaders, they are both world market leaders. Both companies excel in many different transmitter technologies and not always in the same fields. Continental does not compete in the UHF TV transmitter market. Continental is one of the five manufacturers in the world with 500 kilowatt super transmitters. These are the new generation of high-efficiency, frequency-agile, PDM-type shortwave transmitters that have been developed for AM broadcasting into the 21st century. This is a market in which Harris does not compete above the 100 kilowatt level. At even higher powers for use on the long and medium waves, the world leader in terms of highest power is without any doubt Continental. Whilst there are perhaps three or four companies with this ability, Continental is the only company with a 2 megawatt transmitter as a catalogue item. With this kind of experience, designing transmitters for powers of 60 kilowatts or so for the FM transmitter market is a relatively easy task. Continental also excels in the art of combining transmitter outputs. Solid-state technology. It is an accepted fact that solid-state cannot challenge the role of the power grid tetrode in terms of electrical conversion efficiency and in initial equipment costs for FM applications. Advocates of this technology may argue that the next generation of solid-state will see some considerable evolutionary progress. This same claim also applies to tube technology. Continental's dedication to tube technology is total when it comes to generating RF power. The use of solid state is restricted sensibly to their FM802 exciter and to the driver stages in most of their FM transmitter range, the exception being the 814C. This is an all-solid-state transmitter with an output of 3.8 kilowatts. This output is achieved with seven separate solid-state modules, each rated at 700 watts, and used in a splitter-combiner technique, with each module being separately protected against excessive supply voltage, VSWR overload, excessive drive, and high temperature. The 802 50-watt FM exciter has been around for a few years. Continental certainly have no immediate intention of abandoning a design that has stood the test of time and powers many FM transmitters around the world. As is fairly common practice in the FM world, the 802 exciter is capable of being used as a standalone transmitter, with a rated output of 50 watts. Digital LED displays show true peak level of the modulating signal in 5% increments, with overmodulation indicator. The 802 exciter accepts composite baseband signals from a stereo generator, STL system, or monaural and SCA programming.
Just like a sacred cow, the
This is Technical Radio, 6220 daytime, 1611 nighttime. This is Radio Fax, the trade station. Number 1, High Ash Farm, Caister St. Edmund, England, NR14-8RH.
Continuing from Broadcast Systems Engineering, James Wood's Look at Continental Electronics. Power grid technology. This is the area where Continental really perform. Their experience in the design of tubed transmitters is perhaps second to none. The successful design of any transmitter is the result of a two-way partnership with the tube manufacturer, with each contributing his experience. Too many transmitter manufacturers overlook the basic fact that the modern tetrode is a sophisticated device that must be used in accordance with the manufacturer's recommendations in order to fully realize its maximum performance. Indeed, there are some companies with transmitter designers who possess barely adequate knowledge of thermionic tube technology. A fact which in itself is not too surprising when one realises that few universities include thermionic tube technology in the syllabus, but all include solid-state technology. Continental is fortunate to be part of the Varian Associates Group, with Varian iMac as a sister company. Varian iMac is the largest volume producer of thermionic tubes in the world. Quite naturally, Continental use and specify only Varian iMac tubes in their radio transmitters. These same tubes are also used by Harris and other US companies. Continental's range of tube-equipped FM transmitters is almost certainly the largest range offered by any manufacturer, ranging through from 4.3 kilowatts, 5 kilowatts, 10 kilowatts, 20 kilowatts, 25 kilowatts, 27 kilowatts, 35 kilowatts, 60 kilowatts, and 70 kilowatts. The latter transmitter being a dualed arrangement of two 817R transmitters that can provide outputs of 40 kilowatts, two 817R-2s, 50 kilowatts, two 817R-1s, 55 kilowatts, two 817R-3s, or 70 kilowatts, two 817R-5s. Combining transmitter outputs to yield double the output power and at the same time provide 100% redundancy factor is something that Continental are good at. Top of the range is the 60 kilowatt Type 817A, currently the most powerful single tube FM transmitter in the States. Also, with the single possible exception of Thomson LGT of France, the most powerful FM transmitter in the world. With the exception of the final PA stage, the rest of the transmitter is all solid state. The 802 exciter driving a solid state stage to realize an output of 1000 watts with which to drive the final stage. A dual redundant 8-bit microprocessor system provides complete system monitoring and remote control interface over any voice grade circuit that will support data modems at 300 baud speed. Because control of the transmitter is preserved in conventional local control circuitry, deactivation of the microprocessor has no effect on any local control features of the transmitter. Transmitter operational status is shown on a viewing screen that uses a pixel display of large, easily read characters to provide data equivalent to a video display. The display system uses 7 screens. Each screen can display up to 8 lines of 32 characters per line, for a total of 256 characters per screen, or 1792 for the system. The design of the PA stage will be of interest to power engineers. It employs a single iMac 4CX 40,000G tube in a highly stable circuit. Inherently so because of the grounded screen arrangement with a re-entrant half-wave cavity. Filament voltage supply is held to the correct value with a true RMS sensing system. The importance of this latter device on the tube filament supply will not be lost on transmitter engineers who are familiar with vacuum tube technology. Incorrect voltages applied to the filament of a thoriated tungsten tube have an important effect upon the tube life. A 3% increase in filament voltage will result in a 20% Kelvin increase in temperature, a 20% increase in filament emission, and a 50% decrease in tube life. Many transmitter designers who aren't familiar with tube technology produce designs for transmitters without considering the full implications of their design. Steve Clatterbow of Continental readily admits, much of our transmitter technology in the past has been associated with thermionic tubes rather than solid-state technology. In the author's experience, this counts as a strength rather than possible weakness. In the age that we live in, solid-state engineers are to be found in abundance. On the other hand, engineers with real experience of power grid technology are becoming a rare breed for the reasons outlined earlier. Yet, all the indications are that tube-equipped transmitters are going to be around for at least another decade, or even longer for FM transmitters, while in the AM high-powered transmitters field, it is certain that there cannot be any alternative. Moving down the power scale in the Continental FM range, there is a 35 kilowatt transmitter, which embodies much of the IC logic state-of-the-art as is used in the 60 kilowatt transmitter just described. The main differences are in the RF design. The PA stage is a YC130-9019 developed specially for Continental by iMac. This is driven by a pair of 4CX250Bs. The 4CX250B is one of the most remarkable designs of ceramic tetrode ever created. Produced in possibly hundreds of thousands, even iMac have by now lost count. For customers who prefer solid state at the driver level, Continental have produced such a module that can replace the pair of 4CX250Bs. It is believed that this can be retrofitted to existing 816R transmitters already in service. Moving down the power scale, 816R3 has an output of 25 kilowatts, the 816R1, 10 kilowatts, the 815A, 5 kilowatts, and the 814B, 4.3 kilowatts output. The first two employ the 4CX250B driver, followed by either a 4CX15000A or a 4CX10000A. Both of the lower-powered transmitters, rated at 5 kilowatts and 4.3 kilowatts, use only one tube in the complete transmitter. In both cases, the final tube is a 4CX3500A, conservatively rated in both transmitters. As mentioned earlier, Continental manufactures an all-solid-state transmitter, the 814C, with an output of 3.8 kilowatts, which will have appeal to the low-power station operator. However, in the United States, it is the high-powered transmitters, i.e. within the 35 kilowatts to 60 kilowatt range, that find favour with most stations. For this reason, Continental has few competitors and having the ability to produce transmitters at competitive prices, and excellent designs for its 35 kilowatt and 60 kilowatt transmitters should be able to capture a major proportion of this market. Unscheduled downtime is the nightmare that faces all station operators. The time when the station is off the air due to equipment failure at the transmitter end. And this has given the all-solid-state transmitter some advantage in the minds of certain operators. Against this must be countered the major disadvantage that when a failure does occur, it is often total and sometimes catastrophic. Tube-equipped transmitters are less subject to total failure, and very often the transmitter gives some early warning in its circuit operating parameters, i.e. incorrect screen current, etc. Continental place a high degree of importance on minimising downtime by offering a 24-hour service for parts and engineering advice. They have domestic district managers in almost all US, every US state, and international sales and service representatives in 36 locations in the rest of the world. Since then, the British company PiTVT has been acquired by Varian Associates. PiTVT, renamed Varian TVT, joins Continental and the Varian Microwave Equipment Division to form the RF Systems operation of Varian. The acquisition of PiTVT is of considerable importance to Varian. At the beginning of this article, it was noted that the company did not produce VHF and UHF television transmitters. Varian TVT in the UK now fills that gap. As a result, Varian transmitters can now be offered throughout the entire spectrum for terrestrial broadcasting. More than this, it has now increased its international list of sales and service agents outside the United States, an important factor as far as broadcasting agencies are concerned. Without doubt, the acquisition of PiTVT will greatly strengthen the role of Varian Continental in the world market.
And a report, a story that's been widely reported in the press this Easter weekend, has been that microwave ovens have been recalled by Hoover. This report from The Times. Hoover is recalling half its microwave range after an oven overheated in the middle of the night. Seven people, including five children and a baby aged 6 weeks, escaped injury after their home in Hardwick Road East, Worksop, Nottinghamshire, filled with toxic fumes. Firemen were unable to explain how the £300 MicroMaster microwave, which was plugged in but not switched on, managed to smoulder. They informed Nottinghamshire Trading Standards Department, which is now considering legal proceedings. Yesterday, Hoover announced it is recalling four of its MicroMaster models. The numbers are H6312, H6314, H6316 and H6318. Owners are being told not to leave ovens unattended when in use and to pull out the plug when they are also not in use. Mr. Colin Watson, Hoover Chief Engineer of Services, said, "We have organised a public recall as a result of other instances of overheating inside the oven. We have had seven cases reported within the last few weeks, with complaints ranging from flashing and overheating to catching fire. We're putting a modification in four models. They have been on the market the best part of a year, but the problem is only just showing up. It can happen if there is a very small load in the oven, for example, defrosting a bread roll on maximum power." Mr. Brian Clark, aged 38, discovered the melted microwave at 1:30 a.m. and said, "If I had been in sleep, we could all have been killed." Mr. Robert Newman, Assistant Nottinghamshire Chief Trading Standards Officer, advised owners, if you have any doubts, do not use the oven until it has been examined by Hoover.
Video News presented by Roger Tate. And in this edition of Video News, we take a look at the LaserVision video disc format. And sadly, it's RIP, rest in peace, LaserVision. Philips, the inventors of the LaserVision video disc, have now officially discontinued the format in readiness for CDV or compact disc video in the autumn of 1988. The announcement means that LaserVision titles that were planned for release in the very near future have now been scrapped until the CDV format is in full swing. Some of the titles affected include Crocodile Dundee, The Fly, Heartbreak Ridge, The Mission, and Peggy Sue Got Married. The planned repressing of the blockbuster film Alien has also been cancelled. The move to scrap LaserVision totally comes as Philips DuPont have announced that the yield of new CDV discs from their Blackburn pressing plant has been disappointingly low, hence the delay in releasing the new CDV players that had been promised for pre-Christmas launch last year. It's the need for concentration on CDV titles that has meant that all of the pressing capacity has to be devoted to CDV manufacture to ensure that the supply of software can match demand when CDV finally gets the official go-ahead from the planners in Eindhoven in Holland. A quick tour of Oxford Street in London reveals the demise of LaserVision discs. The HMV shop have cut their display by around 75%, with no new titles having been available for some time. Tower Records and the Virgin Megastore have few LaserVision titles in stock, and even Harrods in Knightsbridge only had about 5 discs on show last week. So it's RIP LaserVision. Yes, LaserVision has died. Many video disc owners will bemoan its passing and hope that Philips can get its act together with the release of the new CDV format.
Well, we'll get the right fader up in the end. From The Observer, a profile of Marmaduke Hussey, a duke who leads from the front. The Mike and Dukey TV spectacular last Sunday certainly had its droll moments, illustrating the terrible allure the chat show style holds for public figures. But it usefully demolished the myth that the BBC has been placed in the charge of a feudal vassal of Number 10 and his subservient Manisible. It is easy to recognise how this was created. The only facts most people could remember about Marmaduke Hussey when his surprise appointment as chairman of the governors was announced 15 months ago were that he dined with Tory ministers, was married to one of the Queen's ladies-in-waiting, and had been defeated in the most expensive labour dispute in British company history, the Times Sunday Times 11-month closure in 1978-79, which cost £40 million. Hussey's origins are, as it happens, unimpeachably middle class. He is a highly intelligent man who won an open scholarship from Rugby to Trinity College, Oxford, where he obtained distinctions in his unclassified wartime history degree. The mannerisms of a Fielding squire conceal a disciplined mind. And, notwithstanding that disaster, he was a highly respected professional newspaper manager. It is difficult to make sense of what has been happening inside the BBC without understanding the bizarre, brutalist world of Fleet Street management in which he worked for 30 years. He learned there to lead from the front. That doesn't mean intervening in editorial decisions. Editors who worked for him insist that, once convinced of his journalists' ability, he defended them loyally, as he defended Kate Adey last year from Norman Tebbit's criticism of her reporting of the US raid on Libya. It does mean, as one of Hussey's BBC friends put it, knowing exactly what you want from an organisation and from the people who work for you. There's steel there. It impressed us here that, on day one, he turned up at Lime Grove and listened to people on the shop floor. He doesn't just sit in his office. If the Burt's revolution in news and current affairs doesn't succeed, and the flood of demoralised staff continues to leave the corporation, he'll probably take action. I'd say he's a pragmatist. Hussey is in his broadcasting house office 4 or 5 days a week. He has been careful to respect the BBC's formal command structure. His decisions are sanctioned by the governors and conveyed through the Director General, Michael Checkland, whom he talks to daily. He sees Checkland's deputy, John Burt, once in 4 or 5 weeks, always in Checkland's presence. The Hussey-Burt axis, feared by Burt's critics, appears not to exist. Even so, he is the most interventionist chairman in BBC history. Charles Hill attracted publicity by making speeches. Norman Brooke occasionally put a discreet arm lock on his provocative Director General, Hugh Green. But neither would have dreamt of fronting 3 hours of prime-time introspection. The symbolism is unmistakable. Hussey's antecedents were West Country clergymen, colonial civil servants, and Yorkshire businessmen. His father, Eric Hussey, was an Olympic hurdler in 1908 and a Christian educationalist who worked in the colonial service in Uganda and Nigeria, and later looked after church schools in Britain. As a boy, Duke was regarded as a natural sportsman who happened, through some genetic freak, to be good at exams, an outstanding wing forward and an ungainly but destructive slow left-arm bowler. On the 7th of February 1944, he was a platoon commander in the 5th Battalion, the Grenadier Guards, fighting a bloody battle in the flat terrain outside Anzio when the German parachute division launched a night counterattack. Hussey received a burst of submachine gun bullets at close range, losing a leg and being taken prisoner. 7 months later, when he was being carried out of a military hospital near Frankfurt to be repatriated, the commandant turned out the guard to salute him for his courageous bearing. He eventually returned to Oxford, but was in and out of British hospitals for several years, sometimes critically ill. A bullet lodged in his spine caused agonising osteomyelitis. Doctors told him that if it was not removed, he would probably die, but that the operation had only a 50-50 chance of success. He was lucky. Duke displayed quite extraordinary composure, his tutor, Michael McLagan, recalls. He was on two sticks for most of the time. He did his best to enjoy himself and loved parties. Few of his friends doubt that his continuing physical ordeal helps explain his relish for life and his ruthless spirit in business. He thinks he's bloody lucky to be alive, one of them says. For that reason, he takes a pretty devil-may-care view of everyday obstacles.
To continue with the profile of Marmaduke Hussey from The Observer. He joined Rothermere's Associated Newspapers as a trainee in 1949, eventually becoming managing director responsible for the Daily Mail and Evening News. The opportunist character of the industry had always attracted buccaneers. Like other Fleet Street managers, Hussey found himself sandwiched between an autocratic proprietor above and a mutinous printing union chapels below, eager to exploit every weakness. Only the toughest honchos survived. His relations with Esmond Rothermere were good, but by the late 1960s, the mail circulation was dropping. Hussey failed to persuade Rothermere to invest in the big promotional push he wanted. He was glad to move to Thompson's as chief executive in 1971. He is 64, 6 foot 5 inches tall and weighs 17 stone. His personal warmth and insouciant sense of fun have made him many friends. Duke exploits his tin leg shamelessly, a former colleague says. If he were trying to get a table in a crowded restaurant, he'd tap it with his stick. That usually did the trick. When he wanted to attract sympathy in the office, he would unstrap it and lean it conspicuously against the wall. Someone would come in to chew his balls off, would see this appalling thing with a sock and a shoe on the end, and would visibly falter. Duke would be the pink of politeness. When they'd left, he'd say, "That fixed the bastard," and strap his leg back on. His wife Susan, one of Lord Waldegrave's daughters, is an amusing, strong-minded, intelligent woman who was once unanimously voted by Hussey's friends, assembled over the brandy and cigars, the person they'd most like to be placed next to at dinner. They own a small house on the Wargrave Estates at Chewton Mandip in Somerset, all dogs and gumboots, and a flat in Kensington. They have a son and daughter. By 1978, the Times was being crippled by restrictive practices. The Thompson Board, led by Gordon Brunton, gave the printing chapels an ultimatum. Deal, or we shut down the papers. They miscalculated. When the closure came, most of the printers were able to find alternative jobs, many on other Fleet Street papers. Once Thompson's lost the economic weapon, the logical next move was liquidation of two great newspapers, retaining the titles for some future Greenfield rebirth. Lord Thompson, watching in distress from his Toronto skyscraper, had no stomach for it. Nor, understandably, did some of Hussey's senior colleagues, who had devoted their careers to editing and managing The Times and Sunday Times. Hussey was instructed to settle. It was, in effect, capitulation. There was, and still is, enormous affection for him in Fleet Street, but his career was inevitably seen to have been broken. Many others in the same position would have written a rancorous book. He has never spoken of it publicly, though his friends confirm that he felt bitter. He remained with Thompson's in a backseat job.
When Rupert Murdoch bought the papers, he appointed Hussey a director of Times newspapers, valuing his wide acquaintance in the business world. Hussey's political reflexes are Tory, but he's no dogmatist. Friends like William Rees-Mogg, then the editor of the Times, the Labour Minister Tony Crossland, whom he first knew as an economics don at Trinity, and his brother-in-law, the Housing Minister William Wargrave, educated him in the realities of power. His independence is not in question, but he has spent much of his life amongst courtiers, aristocrats and corporate managers, who believe that any serious journalistic challenge to the power structures of Britain is unpatriotic. "I'm in favour of responsible investigative reporting," is the fashionable catchphrase. For responsible, read, unlikely to produce radical reform. "I long to say that Duke will always stand firm," says an old Fleet Street friend, and Fleet Street and BBC friend. "Quite often he will, but you are already seeing blander programme-making at the BBC. On specific issues, he'll dig in his heels, but he will want there to be fewer of those issues."
In this week's Financial Times, the interim results of AB Electronics, the resistor and thick film manufacturer. Doubled interim pre-tax profits at AB Electronics helped boost the South Wales-based company's shares 35 pence to close at 413 pence during the week. Although turnover grew only 9% from 89.6 million to 97.6 million, pre-tax profits for the 6 months to December 31, 1987 jumped from 3.16 million to 6.35 million. Three of the company's five product groups performed particularly well. Work on a low-current switching system for Jaguar helped move the automotive group from losses into profits. Mr. Peter Phillips, the company's chairman, wouldn't break down profits by sector, but he said that the swing in automotive profits was more than £1 million. There were also strong performances from the assembly and components divisions. But the aerospace and defence group suffered from a slowdown in defence spending, and the telecommunications group was affected by a depressed marketplace. During the year, AB acquired Plessey Connectors and Swansea Industrial Components. It has also entered into a joint venture with an American company, Flexotronics, and is setting up a trading subsidiary in Japan. Operating profits were 7.13 million against 4.06 million and after interest paid of 782,000 against 901,000 and taxation of 2.26 million against 1.21 million. Fully diluted earnings per share were 17 pence against 9.2 pence. The interim dividend is being raised to 3 pence from 2 pence. It has been rare in recent years for an electronics company to produce profits that far exceed expectations, and that makes these excellent results from AB all the more welcome. AB has seen the bad times of the UK electronics industry thanks to its links with Acorn and Sinclair. It continued to invest in new plant and equipment, and its persistence is now paying off. The low-current switching system for Jaguar, which has cost the automotive division a lot of money in the past, is a prime example. Given that the second half is traditionally the stronger, the profits for AB's full-year figures look extremely good. £15 million pre-tax would put the shares up at 4.413 pence on a prospective profit expectancy of 10. That looks a modest rating since the company has managed to produce these excellent figures, despite the weaknesses of the defence and telecommunications sectors.
Brow, I believe.
Broadcasting to the European Community, 6220 daytime, 1611 nighttime. This is Radio Fax, the trade station. Number 1, High Ash Farm, K-Store St Edmund, England, NR148RH.
Audio news from Roger Tate. And in this edition, a review of the new Nakamichi cassette decks that have just been released throughout Europe. In past years, Nakamichi have built up a reputation of being the Rolls-Royce of cassette deck manufacturers. The release of any new model from Nakamichi always creates much interest among hi-fi fans, who always dream of owning such a deck. Now, the release of four new Nakamichis is nothing short of sensational. Nakamichi are not renowned for new models every year, and these latest editions are bound to provoke much comment. The new cassette decks in the range are all in the CR series and called CR1E, CR2E, CR3E and CR4E. They replace the existing BX series machines, adding a further machine to the range, which now numbers 9 cassette decks. The Nakamichi CR1E replaces the old BX100, a budget machine that in the past lacked Dolby C. The new replacement features Dolby B and C noise reduction, LED bar graph meters and a logic-controlled tape transport. It's expected to sell in the United Kingdom for around £345. The new CR2E replaces the BX125 model and offers the same facilities with the addition of a fine bias tune control and a four-digit LED tape counter. Selling price will be around £395. The new Nakamichi CR3E is aimed at the more serious tape user, featuring a dual capstan tape drive, three-head off-tape monitoring and fine bias adjust. It's due to sell at about £595, which is about £50 less than the old BX300, which it replaces. Among the new range, the CR4E is the real gem. It offers the same three-head design and dual capstan drive, but also has the calibration controls that were to be found on mid-price Nakamichi cassette decks some years ago, and dropped when the BX series were first introduced. The calibration controls allow both the bias and Dolby level to be accurately set, thus assuring that the machine is properly tuned for the tape in use. The CR4E doesn't come cheap and sells for around £745 in the United Kingdom. The new Nakamichi CR series all feature similar styling to the upmarket CR7, which has been on the United Kingdom market for about 2 years. The price is unchanged on that one, a mere £1,500. And all of the new machines offer memory stop, auto-repeat and a time-switch facility. For more information about the Nakamichi CR series cassette decks, contact the importers. Nakamichi B&W Limited, Churchill Industrial Estate, Lancing, West Sussex in England. This has been a short report on the Nakamichi CR series, presented by Roger Tate.
And Neil Asherton of The Observer had some interesting views on radio generally in his article entitled Petticoat Lane Takes to the Air. In broadcasting, as in most forms of communication, there are national styles. But what is interesting about them isn't so much the style itself as the setter of style. Which elite, really imagined, past or present, is being imitated? There was a time when the BBC style was fearfully patrician. The accent was, well, what shall we say, lordly, although in fact that artificial plumminess was neither the drawl of real dukes nor that peculiar twanging on two vowels which is the elocution now affected by the royal family. The substance was impressively grave, leavened with the occasional heavy joke. If the old announcers on radio wore dinner jackets to read the news, the manner was after dinner. German television takes its style from a different model. I was reminded of this by the current row in West Germany over old Werner Höfer, who for countless years had presided over the Sunday discussion programme called Freischoppen. Höfer's now in disgrace. The magazine Der Spiegel resuscitated some truly revolting articles he wrote as a prominent Nazi commentator, one of them gloating over the execution of a young pianist found guilty of defeatist talk in the war. I took part in his programme on several occasions and always had the feeling that he was probably an old Nazi. He had a certain combination and domineering brusqueness with a sardonic, almost liberal attitude to the modern world, which marks the more intelligent survivors. But it's the programme rather than the man that's the point. A group of foreign journalists would sit round a table with a glass of German wine and debate current world affairs under Höfer's chairmanship. At the end, however, we'd violently disagreed. There was supposed to be a coming together of minds as we raised our glasses and toasted each other. Höfer hated real contradictions and at times almost bullied his guests into the semblance of concord. The great phrase in Western Germany then was Volle Unterspannung, complete agreement and unanimity. Everything had to end in that. Here the style model was plainly professional. Radio and television commentators lectured. Public figures were encouraged to drone on in abstract terms, while interruption was rare and rather scandalous. For me, this was a delicious new experience. Accustomed to the British treatment of journalists as dirty rats to be thrown off the doorstep, I found myself welcome with vast respect when I entered my profession. Ach, Herr Doktor, please come in. One could go on. Polish television is full of snappy gallantry to ladies, preposterous statements and technical disasters, features of the life of petty aristocracy. But it's important to point out that these styles do change as one model is gradually substituted for another. Like most of us, I watch far too much television over Christmas and the New Year holiday. But it made me realise that a new style is spreading throughout broadcasting, radio and television alike in this country. It's a relentless, elbow-grabbing chattiness. It's the patter of disc jockeys, but it's also the high-speed, nudge-nudge wit of guests on radio question shows. It's the noisy, caged intimacy of those who present quiz and prize programmes. But it's also Sir Robin Day on Question Time, as he harasses, challenges, flatters and galvanises a shy, invited audience. Less and less often do broadcasters simply say what they wish to say. Instead, they behave as if their audience was no longer captive, but free-ranging, an attention to be lassoed. Sometimes it is as if the speaker was trying to penetrate a barrier of noise and bustle between him and the potential listener or viewer. Sometimes it's as if the raised voice and rapid wisecrack were meant to hit and stop a passerby on a pavement. And of course, that's it. It's the Cockney street hay trader style that's really taking over. It's, here you are, lady, just for you. Rockin' tomatoes for a nice soft art like yours, lady. Down the centuries, stallholders and peddlers, quacks and fair day preachers have sold by patter and wit, perfecting through generations the art of making people stop, listen, laugh and then buy. It's the voice of Brick Lane, Petticoat Lane, Portobello Road. But how did it become the voice of broadcasters? There's no obvious answer. Part of it, I'm sure, is the surge of commercial competition. The British ether has itself become a street market in which dozens, if not hundreds, of legal and illegal radio stations and television companies hustle for audiences and advertisements. And, as we know all too well, the BBC itself has been coerced into the ratings war, as if the corporation were already dependent on commercial breaks for its revenue. The stand-up comic is back in vogue, a figure whose trade and ancestry is close to that of the salesman-entertainer. I heard a programme the other day about warm-up men, the comics who get studio audiences going before the real show begins. It's their skill and outlook which is spreading. Broadcasting is becoming one long warm-up. And somewhere inside this process is the steady cocknification of mass culture. It was in the 1960s that the middle-class London young discovered the fun and vigour of East End style, clothes, repartee, even the fascination with villainy. Now public schoolboys talk with modified Cockney accents and Sloanes call the police the Old Bill. As radio and television fall into the Petticoat Lane style, London's growing dominance over all British life takes on a new dimension. Centralism in a pearly waistcoat. It's a tide flowing away from understanding. I've always believed that news has a right to be dull. put in another way, things that people need to know are not to be sold like Korean teddy bears that fell off the back of a lorry. Hello, lady, rosy cheeks, see you got one last night. Here's the Caribbean nations refusing to boycott elections in Haiti, held under military rule. In really sour moments, I watch those suspiciously jolly-clad men and girl teams wriggling with suppressed mirth who read the news on television and wait for the moment when they put on their funny red noses. And the other night, one did. Bilious complaints? Well, it's strange to see British broadcasting underrating itself. Until now, its problems often arose from excellence. An example has been the cult of good television, the British craftsmanship which makes editors and producers polish a documentary until it becomes a seamless, burnished product which, deprived of all the knobs, snags and cracks of reality, slips through the consciousness, leaving almost no sensation behind. But by behaving as if current affairs programmes, for instance, were third-rate products which have to be feverishly marketed as entertainment, broadcasters ensure that they will indeed become third-rate. One barrier to the triumph of the street trader style remains. This is the population of the House of Commons. A very new politicians have learned how to hustle and patter. Most, however, would have trouble selling a welt to a starving man. Boring, self-obsessed and sometimes paranoid, they're immune to the temptation to be professionally winning. Sometimes drearily and sometimes well. They say what they want to say and they can do no other. They couldn't warm up a bowl of soup, let alone a Wogan audience, and yet it's fact that they all sold themselves to a large number of voters. If people will buy goods as unpromising as that, then so hope does remain. And that was the view of Neil Asherson in last Sunday's Observer.